From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps, if we are on our game, some insight into the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, your host here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, down there at the end of the table here. Good morning, sir. Good afternoon.
Hi,
and good evening.
Rex.
It's great to see you. And we are joined here by Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose. Professor, great to see you.
Good to see you, and happy Sunshine Week, even though it will not be next week. It is this week.
Sunshine Week, not pertaining to the weather, but rather to open government. We'll get to that. And Judy Patrick is here, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. How are you?
Yeah, definitely not pertaining to the weather this week, but happy Sunshine Week for me as well.
Yeah, a little dull. You know, it's great that we're all here, and we have to think about what a great career opportunity this is for us now that the president has chosen a broadcast commentator to be his chief economic advisor. Think about what this program could mean for our futures, for each of us. Larry Kudlow of CNBC is becoming the head of the National Economic Council. Isn't this something? Because the president apparently watches him and likes what he has to say.
Except that it's very interesting, and as the news media do its job parsing this appointment. I mean, here is the president who appoints Kudlow, who is taking over from Mr. Cohn, who's leaving. But they both agree with each other, which is that the tariffs are a terrible idea. Now, that's interesting. In one case, we think Cohn resigned because he wasn't being listened to. And now we have another guy coming in. And clearly, if he's opposed to the president and his tariffs, he'll be. So what I worry about is that the news media doesn't really lay it all out for us.
I worry less about that than just about the notion that people going from being commentators to being policymakers. You know, when Trump was a presidential candidate back in 2016, he was asked who his military advisors are. And he said, I watch the shows. And he listed a couple of the retired colonels, you know, who are on broadcast.
That's a riot.
So, you know, I figure I'm likely to be the next senior policy advisor to the Brunswick town supervisor. You know, I've got,
well,
got a great future here.
When I got hired as a commentator at Channel 6, years ago by Don Decker, he said, the first most essential thing is you have to promise me that under no conditions will you run for public office. And I said, okay, I agreed to that. I had already been in a powerful position. I had been elected selectman in Alford, Massachusetts, population 500 or whatever it was, you know, at the time. But I did it. And then, Rex, you may remember this incident. There was a reporter who was a little lazy. He was doing a story about, you know, who would be on a commission. I guess it was a Troy paper, and there was the fifth potential person for public service commission, something like that, was Alan Shartok. Don Decker blew his top. He said, you swore to me that you would not run or you wouldn't take advantage of this. I said, I never even heard of the commission. What are you talking about?
There's another Alan Shartok?
He made...
Wow, that's so exciting.
The guy, he called the guy, and the guy admitted that he had made it up.
Well, it's synchronous, right? Isn't it that the current reality TV president would be choosing someone who is also a star in the broadcast industry?
What was that word? Synchronous? What did you mean by synchronous?
It makes sense that that's what he's doing because that's what's happening in that administration. I would not put my stamp of approval on it if anyone cared about that.
But. So, Professor, synchronous means...
In sync?
Yeah, in sync. With, like the band.
Yeah.
So, as troubling it is as of having a TV commentator become part of Trump's inner circle, he already was part of Trump's inner circle. I should note that the news media also accurately reported that Kudlow does have some chops in this field. He spent 10 years at Bear Stearns. He worked in the Office of, you know, Management and Budget for many years. So he's not simply a commentator, but it illustrates the fact that people go back and forth between media and the real world far too easily nowadays.
It's been 10 years since he actually was a practicing economist. How would you feel about having to go out and be a reporter on the street again? I would not feel capable.
I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah.
And things have changed in the economy drastically, but it appears that Trump has drawn him in because he agrees with him.
Let me get this straight. You are opposed, Judy Patrick, to this back and forth stuff between media and political or office.
You know, I'm such a traditionalist. It always has made me easy that people go back and forth. I think of journalists as journalists and the rest of the world as the rest of the world. I understand that they're press spokespeople for the Department of Defense and then they become MSNBC commentators. It has always made me a little uneasy. I understand they bring an expertise to the realm, but I don't know when are they going to go back the other way.
Sure. Yep. And what are they doing when they're there? In other words, are they laying the groundwork for their next appearance in government?
Exactly. Yeah. How much credibility can you attach to what they're saying? You know, the talk is now that the next person to go from the commentariat into the government might be John Bolton, the long ago failed UN ambassador who's been a Fox News contributor who may well become the next national security advisor, which is a kind of terrifying notion. But while we're talking about these conflicts between government and the media, what happens now? So Chris Cuomo, brother of the incumbent governor, son of the late former governor, is going to get a primetime show on CNN. He's going to be up against Rachel Maddow on MSNBC and Hannity on Fox. What happens if his brother runs for president? How's he going to be able to cover this stuff?
Well, yeah, and not only that, his brother is under a little bit of a cloud right now. His top people are being convicted, or at least one of them was. I mean, to what degree does a brother of the governor have to, you know, cover?
Recuse himself, yeah. Right? Does he have to recuse himself from the coverage of all national politics and that campaign and anything that's remotely related to it? How is he able to function as a journalist and avoid covering that? That's a good question.
Couldn't it hobble him? I mean, we are at a point where we're not supposed to ally spouses, I guess. You know, Chuck Todd's wife is a Democratic political consultant. And we're not supposed to look at that. We're supposed to say, you know, people have their independent lives. But
sure.
If your brother is a prominent political figure, as is the case with Cuomo, and the two guys kind of look and sound alike somewhat.
Well, when you say, well, you're exactly right, Judy. Judy won't say it, but you know, Chris can speak the language pretty well. The other guy's not so good.
And the governor looks
thuggish.
No, weary, I think. He has worry lines. Chris Cuomo doesn't seem to have any worry lines. And he's a trained broadcaster.
Yeah.
And a credible one. I think he does a fairly good job when he's posing questions in hard interviews. Yeah, he is tough.
Can be.
But I agree that it will be difficult if the governor of New York decides to run for president. But I mean, I think we should cross that bridge when it comes.
Well, not only that, I'll give you another potential disaster here. We do know the great war is in New York. It's between de Blasio, the mayor of New York, and the governor, Cuomo. Now, the question is, why do they hate each other? I happen to have a hypothesis that they both want to be president of the United States, and they're both setting themselves up. They're both traveling. They're both doing what they have to do in order to do this. Now, when Chris Cuomo, for example, gets involved in questioning these guys, is there going to be a perception of favoritism?
I think Cuomo's not going to be able to do this job. I think he'll be Megyn Kelly'd.
Megyn Kelly'd.
Yeah, I think he'll end up being a talk show host in a roundtable, sort of the View circumstance. It's not possible for him to cover that sort of campaign. He cannot be fair. I won't use the word objective because I don't ascribe to that fantasy. But I think he cannot be fair in covering his brother. So his employer is going to have to make a decision about what to do with him.
You don't have to
give
worry.
Him more money and have him work on a talk show and invite people in to talk about dress sizes.
You don't really have to worry. Andrew Cuomo's not going to be president.
Right. The Kirsten Gillibrand card may be played or something.
We'll see. You know, your predictions are not going so well these days. You predicted that Prococo would walk. I did.
I have to admit. I did.
Well, there
and
you go.
You're absolutely right.
Thank you very much.
But I'm not a scaredy cat like some people I know. I put it right out there, and if it goes well, it goes well.
Did our
listeners hear Alan say that Rex was right? That's the part.
So, speaking of policies coming out of Washington, there is something that really could be problematic for those of us who still use ink on crushed trees, which is newsprint. The Department of Commerce has an anti-dumping plan on Canadian imports of uncoated groundwood paper. That is, publishers are going to have to pay a lot more for newsprint as a result of this tariff that is going to be imposed by the Trump administration. And the pressure on this, by the way, is coming from a single U.S. creator of this product. There is one U.S. producer up in Washington State. Almost all of the newsprint, the wood used for newsprint, comes from Canada. It is going to be a tremendous problem. Diane Kennedy, who runs the New York News Publishers Association, says the Trump administration's tariffs on newsprint will cause layoffs of newspaper staff and could leave many rural areas without access to newspapers.
So what's your point? Is your point that Trump is doing it purposely to get even with the news media, which he hates?
I don't think he personally has any knowledge of this. I think it's the kind of thing, you know, it's not the kind of thing that the president pays enough attention to.
Well, you know, he is a get-even kind of guy.
And is it a circuitous route? That is a good question. Is there some intentionality here to further constrict?
Wait, are you agreeing with me?
I am. It's a record-breaking day here at the Media Project. But that they would constrain the importing of paper product would absolutely, as Rex said, hurt the industry. And the industry cannot bear that. And even the American Forest and Paper Association, which represents the U.S. paper industry, opposes the petition along with publishers and printers concerning this issue. So,
and I know you're going to hate this, but it's just not the industry that gets hurt. It's the readers, because what happens when newsprint prices go down is we start having to cut pages. We have to print less news.
When the price goes up, that's right.
But the supply goes down, right?
To cut our costs, we have to print fewer papers. We shrink the size of the page. Some newspapers stop printing on certain days. And at the end of the day, that means less news gets out to the citizenry.
But I always ask you this question. You guys all jump down my throat and you tell me that I'm wrong. But it always seems to me, since so many newspapers are printing less and newspapers are going out of business and all the rest of it, or going to the web, that why, under the law of supply and demand, if the demand is less for newsprint, why does the price keep going up?
If the demand is less for newsprint, why does the price keep going up?
You know,
in this case, the price is going up because of the duties, because of the tariffs.
Well, yeah, now, but that's in the present tense. What about up to now?
Well, you know, these paper mills can't just come online and off with a drop of a hat. And so producers have reduced capacity. They're actually producing less newsprint as a result of the demand change.
But like 10 years ago, you saw an increase in newsprint, and newspapers responded by cutting pages, reducing the size of their sections. And as a result, some of these mills went offline. And so there are fewer of them now. The same thing will likely happen if this goes into effect. I think we have a few months in the summer this would be finalized.
And, you know, just an indication of how pressed newspapers are, as we were sitting down to tape this, I saw a notice that the hedge fund that owns the Denver Post is imposing further huge cuts there. They have about 90 people in their newsroom. They think they're going to lose another one-third of their newsroom. That's a very small newsroom for a paper of that size, for a community the size of Denver, which used to have two healthy daily papers just 10 years ago. But that company is owned by the same lousy company that owns Troy, Saratoga Springs, and Kingston here in New York and Oneida, and that used to own the Berkshire Eagle until it was recently sold. And so the Denver Post has terrible.
You're not just saying that because my column runs in all those papers that you've just named, are you?
That's not what makes them lousy. Sorry. No, I'm sorry. It's not the papers that are lousy. It's the company. It's the terrible company owned by a hedge fund. And this is the danger of journalism companies being owned by financial interests rather than individuals or communication industries. You know, if you're an over-leveraged hedge fund, all you care about is where you're going to get your assets. And if you have to achieve your margin by reducing the headcount in your newsroom, well, so be it. And it doesn't matter what happens to the community.
There are exceptions, though, to this, too, right? With Jeff Bezos and the Amazon model, where he's taken over the Washington Post. Yes. And the Washington Post is developing a bigger subscriber base. So there are instances where there are corporations that do want to support the newspaper industry and what it stands for and what it does, even perhaps when the return on investment is not as high.
Well, I'm a big Bezos fan, but I wanted to ask you, do you think it's possible that the richest man in the world or the second richest man in the world might say, be nice to own a newspaper and get my own brand of news out there?
Yeah, I think
certainly it's possible.
Yeah. I think he believes in what he's doing, absolutely. That's why he's doing it, right? That's why a lot of people originally produced newspapers, because they wanted to
sure.
have an impact in their communities.
We still have names in our area like the Press Republican, things of that kind.
Yeah. Newspapers at the time in the 19th century were overtly partisan, and that's why they were created. I used to be the editor of a newspaper called The Republican. And what I think is funny was that that county also had a newspaper called The Democrat, and then the Republican bought out The Democrat. It was owned by the same guy.
Yeah, so these are like patrons of, you know, do newspapers need patrons? But then you live in, or die at the whim of the patron. You know, back in the day.
Absolutely.
Back in the day, you know, the great art of our time was produced because patrons paid artists to produce them. Is this what we've come to?
Which is why, even when a good group of people comes along, let's say, and buys a newspaper to do the public good, somebody always inevitably rises to the top of that group. And then you say, okay, so what's the difference if it's a Hearst, in your case, Rex, or, you know, somebody who's running a not-for-profit, basically, newspaper?
What's that? The question is, what's the difference of...
Well, what? No, the real question is, what's the difference if, in fact, a newspaper tends to reflect the views of the person who's running it?
You're talking about the editorial page, I presume, or you... What,
well, you and I have always duked it out on this thing, because
I think
there's a bleed from the editorial page, even in a great newspaper like the New York Times, to the news columns.
Humans run newspapers. Humans make decisions based on their particular point of view and their subjectivity. There is no such thing as objectivity in journalism. You try to be fair and accurate and deliver the news in a way that attracts the most readers, viewers, listeners, and tries to educate the citizenry so they can make informed decisions in a democracy.
Well, Professor.
I'd like to associate myself with her remarks.
And so would Judy. But you will, of course, I would have to agree with you and say it's all relative. In other words, there are some that are really awful, and then there are some that are less awful.
And news literacy efforts such as the one at Stony Brook, which was written about in this month's SPJ,
the
Society for Professional Journalists magazine, The Quill, is talking about this free news literacy online educational opportunity that any of us can go to and take a free news literacy class. So that's where part of the issue needs to be remedied. We need to have individuals who are trained in how to understand what is real news, and then they will hopefully gravitate to what is real.
I would like to respond and say, that ain't going to happen.
Well, I believe we have to hope that it does and try. We have to do. I was at the conference of the state, New York State Association for Social Studies last week, where the Outstanding Social Studies Educator of the Year Award was given to a woman who works for the News Publishers Association, Mary Miller, who runs their news literacy programs that go into classrooms around the state. So there is an effort underway. There are a lot of news literacy programs going on now in high schools that are usually associated with social studies and civics classes, which is a really good thing. And we just need to try to spread that and get more so that people understand that there's a difference between the propaganda that you might see from
the New York Post
and
the
Free Brand, or fake stuff posted online and what is really reputable and trustworthy. And by the way, if you want to share your views, media@wamc.org is how you reach us. We are Kaylin Brown and Judy Patrick and Alan Shartok and Rex Smith. We are this week's Media Project team. That's us. Who is not here is Rosemary Armeo, who for many years was on these microphones. And Rosemary is off working with an organization called OCCRP, which is an organization that supports investigative reporting.
In other countries, too.
Right, absolutely. And a journalist who worked with OCCRP was murdered in his home in Slovakia while working on a story. So these journalists have come together to work on the story that probably got him killed. And they're not now trying to press for legislative changes to prevent this from happening to other journalists.
You know, this journalist had only reached the point where he or she had filed Freedom of Information requests. The person wasn't even going out and questioning people at this point. The simple filing of a Freedom of Information request is what prompted this. And when you read about all the atrocities happening to journalists around the world, journalists here live in a splendid place, but people, especially in Pakistan, they're facing horrible conditions, simply trying to do their job. And what's happening is they're self-censoring and not writing or producing news that the people really need.
But are you chilled, Judy, when you hear Donald Trump say that the press is the enemy of the people? In other words, isn't that sort of setting us up for the model that so many other totalitarian regimes practice?
Agree. That's the road I think he's taking us down, but there's very strong resistance. I think so far we're in good shape. but it's something we all need to be aware of.
You know, this happened once in the United States. Back in 1973, an investigative reporter for the Arizona Republic, Don Bowles, went to his car to ostensibly to go to a meeting with a source, and he turned the ignition and the car blew up, and he lingered for a long time and died. And ultimately, many, many years later, a man was convicted. A man who had been trying to discourage this story was convicted. But what happened was a whole bunch of American reporters came together to finish Don Bowles' investigation. That became known as the Arizona Project. It led to the creation of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, IRE, which, by the way, Rosemary Armeo used to run. So that is the tradition of journalists coming in to say, this work will not stop, even if you take out a journalist. But, you know, the fact is that dozens, literally dozens of journalists die every year in pursuit of the story, sometimes governments killing journalists with impunity. And I agree. I think there's a great danger that as the president builds enmity and keeps telling people that the media is un-American, is unpatriotic, you're going to get some crazy people who are going to say they're going to attack the journalists.
Which is so interesting, Rex, because we are now looking at, in gun control, we are now looking at identifying people who are likely to be violent and giving government the chance to go in, grab their weapons and things. These are the proposals that are on the table. Now, I've been getting mail lately, and I think what happens when a president says all restraints are off, I've been getting mail, which I could not read on these microphones, which go on and on and on, 9-10 paragraphs, and the F word is used repeatedly in the rest of it. Is that somebody who people might want to, police agency might want to take a look at? It's not going to happen.
I think that Judy's observation about this story that Rosemary shared with us is really important, though, about it was an FOI that triggered the eventual violent death of this journalist in Slovakia and his partner. The fact that an FOI is filed, for most journalists, we are not expecting that that request is going to be shared with countless humans. But it does happen. It's happened to me. I think it may have happened to several of us at this table. I'm not sure.
Sure.
Where someone says, I understand that you filed this, or what are you looking for? I mean, I had that happen to me in connection with our students as recently as the past year. A person who should have had no idea that we had filed an FOI with the State Department of Homeland Security, in fact, said, what are you guys looking for? Which was troublesome and concerning. And I think Rosemary makes a very good point, and I'm glad she shared it with us.
Yeah, absolutely. She tells the story of having been a reporter in Cleveland and filing a FOIL for some court clerks. The clerks got on the phone right away to those judges saying it's a courtesy. But basically what they're doing is saying there's a reporter poking around looking for your information.
Watch out.
So what we have to do is put ourselves in the place of these guys and women who say, I don't want these reporters bothering me. We know what they do, right? They hold on forever before they give you what you want. Rex, you've been through that 1,000 times. Mm. You've had to sue them and the rest of it. So we pretty well know what happens. We put ourselves in their place. I would hate to think I would be that way, but I am sure as they get scared, there's a resistance to FOIs.
I think people never think that it's going to happen to them. I think that reporters really believe that just like a photographer in a war zone somehow gets the sense that the camera protects him from danger. I think a reporter doesn't think that there's going to be a problem coming when you file a FOIL, and this sadly tells us that there may well be. We are out of time.
No.
It's true. Kaitlin Brown from the College of St. Rose, Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette, Alan Shartok, he who runs this microphone, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Thank you for joining us on the Media Project.
No one runs you, Rex.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.